And welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based support, educational therapy, academic therapy, and IEP coaching by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. The Special Ed Strategist podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs and the IEP process.
Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Thank you for joining us today. I'm really excited. We have Dr. Ali Navidi joining us. And today our topic is the role of GI health in psychology, what they have on the brain-gut connection. Super fascinating, and appreciate you taking your earbud time to listen in. If you have not liked and subscribed, please go and do that to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, and also follow us on social at Learning Essentials. So Dr. Ali Navidi is a psychologist. He's a licensed clinical psychologist who uses clinical hypnosis and cognitive behavioral therapy to help patients with gastrointestinal disorders, chronic pain, and other complex medical conditions. Dr. Navidi is a director and co-founder of GI Psychology, a national behavioral health practice specializing in the effective treatment of GI disorders for children through adults. He maintains a separate private practice in Burke, Virginia. Dr. Navidi is a founder and past president of the Northern Virginia Society of Clinical Hypnosis and currently volunteers on the board for Washington Independent Services for Educational Resources, or WISER, which is a group of professionals collaborating to help individuals with learning and accessibility needs. Such a huge welcome, and thank you for joining us today, Dr. Navidi.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for that introduction. And I'm really glad to get started and talk with you. I know we've got a bunch of really interesting topics to cover. Let's get to it.
Yeah. So I have talked to folks in my world about this podcast. I've been really excited to chat with you. What is GI psychology, and how are those GI issues linked to one's psychological wellness?
So GI psychology is a broad field talking about the connection between our GI system, our gut, and our brain. And there's been tons of research about this relatively recently, maybe over the last 20 years, looking at something called the brain-gut axis. And that is just a way of saying that the brain and the gut have a special relationship, and they are constantly communicating with each other. And that's good for patients that have GI problems, because often if there's things that we can change in the brain, then the gut will get better.
And that's interesting you say that, because on a lot of my social feeds and just, you know, news feeds and all of that good stuff, you see the opposite, right? Get rid of, you know, heal the gut and then the brain. So yours is kind of that opposite approach. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly what you're hearing. You know, and I don't discount in any way the importance of nutrition, the importance of the microbiome, and those are also very exciting areas. And I just say, let's not ignore the other way around, because there's actually, and this isn't even a new thing, there's over 30 years of really solid research showing that if we can make changes in the brain, then we get improvements in the GI system for certain problems. And let me make that clear.
So what are some of the more common GI issues, especially in children, just because that is the population I support, or school-aged children, that are linked to psychological disorders?
Well, the one that I'd say probably most parents know about would be the tummy ache before school, the tummy ache Sunday night, the anticipatory stomach aches. I had a friend who our kids would play together a lot when they were young. And even as they got older, he could never have a sleepover, because what would happen when he would go to have a sleepover? his stomach would start hurting. And it was really reliable. His stomach would start hurting. His mom would have to go pick him up. And then his stomach would feel better. Yeah. And so, and that's so common. I think every parent pretty much probably knows about that. And then there's things like IBS, so irritable bowel syndrome. And that's where there's GI dysfunction as well as pain. You know, it's kind of cute when the kids maybe get the pain every once in a while, but sometimes these problems can turn into very chronic, even debilitating issues. They cause a loss of, you know, being able to go to school. Patients will stop doing activities because their stomach is hurting, or they're afraid they might have to run to the bathroom. And so there's a whole category of these disorders that gastroenterologists, they used to call functional disorders. And that means the child is going to be having, let's say, pain, or they're going to be having bathroom issues. Maybe they're nauseous. Maybe they feel kind of bloated and full and uncomfortable. And they're going to go through all these tests, and they're going to get blood tests and ultrasounds, and they're going to get scoped up, down, left, right. And at the end of the day, the doctors really aren't going to find anything. And that's where we come in. And so they used to call these functional disorders. And these are disorders where there's no organic problem, but the function is still disturbed. But they changed the name, which I think is very exciting. They changed the name of these disorders to disorders of gut-brain interaction.
Oh, I like that. It's more clear, right? Yeah. It gives you a clear set of what you're trying to accomplish and how that interrelates. So are these clear issues comorbid, or do the GI issues typically cause the psychological component?
It happens both ways. And so what I've seen over the years and what the research shows is that the kiddos who struggle with anxiety, they're going to be more likely to develop what they call these somatic symptoms or psychophysiologic symptoms. So, you know, when they struggle with anxiety, they're more likely to get the tummy aches. They're more likely to get the headaches. They're even more likely to get different kind of chronic pain issues. And we can definitely go into why that happens, why the anxiety makes that happen more often, but it absolutely definitely happens. And then the other way around. So if somebody develops chronic pain in their stomach and they're missing school and they can't go to soccer practices, they're more likely to get depressed and to feel anxious when they go out, because they start worrying that their stomach's going to hurt, or where's the bathroom, and I don't feel safe. And so it can happen kind of both ways.
That's a vicious cycle.
Absolutely.
So then how can parents help children with somatic symptoms? Like, what are some specific strategies?
Yeah. And so always when you're getting a new symptom, you always want to get it checked out. You always want to, you know, go to your primary care. And, you know, primary care, they see a lot of this. So they tend to be pretty savvy about it. And so often they can spot, you know, the danger signals of something really, some serious GI issue. And they might just tell you, hey, you know, is he a little stressed? Is she having some trouble at school? And so they're already looking at the stress component. And so once they get it checked out, the next step is they really want to create safety, because these symptoms are all about not feeling safe in their own body. And so the child needs to really understand that there isn't anything wrong with them and that their body is fine. And it's their brain that's just misinterpreting the signals. That's why they call it a disorder of gut-brain interaction. The way they're interacting, the brain is getting these signals and it's thinking it's dangerous when it's really not.
So what should parents not say or do when it comes to those somatic symptoms and GI psychological issues?
Yeah, that's great, because there are some definite things they shouldn't do. Once we know that a disorder is we call it DGBI, so disorder of gut-brain interaction. Once we know it's a disorder like that and that there isn't anything structurally wrong, but it's chronic, the parents need to avoid treating the child as if they're broken or they're hurt. You know, that if you give too much empathy, if you kind of coddle them too much, it's sending a message to them that there is something wrong. So I'm not saying to be harsh. I'm not saying to be mean, but you don't want to give them the message that they do need to stay home, that they can't do their activities. Because what we found is, you know, once they start missing school, then the cycle really gets ugly, because you miss school, you fall behind in the work, and then school becomes an anxiety-provoking stimuli. And then layer on top of that all the GI symptoms. And of course, the anxiety about school is going to make the GI symptoms worse. And then when the GI symptoms are worse, they're going to miss more school. And we'll often work with patients who have been out of school for a long time. And it's so hard to get them back because there's just layers of problems at that point.
That's interesting you mentioned school refusal. And kind of to go back to some of those strategies, it becomes this push-pull, kind of trying to find that sweet spot with each kid, because each kid is so different. And to say, you know, I know we don't want them to have that anxiety layered on with the school refusal component and build that up, but really, isn't it this, how do you, as a parent, do you suggest finding that balance of not being harsh, but being too harsh, and kind of walking through that, you know, A, getting them to where they need to go, the student, the child, and then B, kind of maybe a follow-up with that, with your child, and saying, you know, what did you feel before? And now what do you feel? And kind of debriefing.
I think the parents, they need to balance between the issue of safety and getting them out there. Because we know, you know, the more they avoid, the worse the anxiety and the problem is going to get. But if they push too hard and they don't do it with a sense of safety, the kid is going to get re-traumatized. The anxiety will get worse. And so that's where you need to have people who can work with the school. And you want to make sure that whatever the issue, you do your best to work with the school to create that safety. So if the issue is pain, giving them options for being able to go in a quiet place and to relax and take it easy, free access to the bathroom, whatever the issue is that's scaring them about going to school, you want to do your best to work with them so that they can face what they're anxious about, but do it with as much safety as you can create.
As a practitioner, how do you kind of help facilitate that with families and bridging that gap with the school in terms of, you know, I always see kind of practitioners in a education setting as two separate silos. So how do you know, education has how they move forward and educate, and they have their kind of realm of what they do. And then we have the practitioners that are supporting our students outside of class. How do you help parents kind of bridge that communication gap where a school will be on board with better supporting a student and figuring out a kind of what is at school that is triggering some of these symptoms? And then as a practitioner for you, how do you help that parent guide that conversation? Just create a space where that child feels safe.
Yeah, I think I see my role often as, you know, first and foremost is education. So we need to understand the nature of the problem that we're facing. We need to understand how these problems work, whether it's IBS or whether it's chronic pain in the belly, whether it's nausea or some other chronic pain syndrome. They need to understand how the psychology affects the physical. And once we can get that basic understanding, nothing too complicated, with the parents, with the school, then we can have a reasonable discussion about, okay, what can we do to make it more likely that the kid is going to be able to succeed, that they're going to be able to either get back into school or be able to continue going to school.
And so at what age might a parent begin to see these GI issues impacting their child's mental wellness?
I would say, you know, you might have kids that have had GI issues since they were really little, you know, even younger than six, but around 6 years old and up is where you start seeing it affect them a little bit more in terms of their life. And so that's the age where we have, you know, because there's a lot of research behind this kind of work. And the treatments are very successful. And so as an example, one of the protocols that we use, the youngest age for that protocol is 6 years old. And it's got good evidence that it's effective at 6 years old and up. Because, and I think they tested it on those ages because that's where you first start seeing these problems kind of creeping into and affecting their lives a little more.
So what advice, if you have a parent and they are starting to experience this with their child in terms of this anxiety and thoughts and feelings and impacting actions and then, you know, impacting their gut, what advice do you have for a parent who can't seem to get a concrete diagnosis? They've gone to their pediatrician. They're just trying to figure out, they're in the beginning stages, right? So they haven't even known that you're around yet. They're trying to figure out, who can I turn to that's going to help me with my baby?
Right. The first step is, of course, the pediatrician. And then if there continues to be issues, you want to see a pediatric gastroenterologist. And they're going to be able to determine, usually pretty effectively, if we need more tests or if we don't, because they look at certain danger signals and there are certain symptoms that they're looking for. And I'm not a pediatric gastroenterologist, but I'm friends with a bunch of them. I've kind of heard their spiel, but I don't know it well enough to repeat it. But there's certain danger signals. And if they're going on, then they definitely need a lot more testing. And if they're not, that's a good signal that this might be a gut brain problem. And by the way, for parents, if it is, that's really good news. You know, often parents, the one mistake I see them make often is they're looking for something that's wrong. They're saying, my child is in so much pain. There has to be something wrong. They need to find it. They just haven't found it yet. And so then they search and they push and they get test after test and they go to doctor after doctor. And it's not good for the kid and it's missing the point. And the point is there isn't anything wrong. And they need to get started treating that brain-gut interaction. And the more tests they put them through, the more chance there is that they might, you know, in the medical world, there's this phenomena basically where if you get enough tests done, eventually you'll find something. And it might not be, you know, clinically significant at all, but if you're looking for something, eventually you'll find it. And that can push parents in the wrong direction really easily.
So after all of this, what, you know, they've gone to their different doctors, they've checked out, they've done the test. Yeah. And then they realize, okay, this is, you know, functional issue between the brain and the gut. What is the first step when addressing GI psychology in children and adolescents? Kind of let's get into what you do as a practitioner. Yeah.
If a patient comes to us and they, you know, been checked out, and we're like, okay, we're fairly certain this is a DGBI, this is a functional issue. We start orienting them to what that treatment looks like. And we also let them know the good news that even though they might have been in pain for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, that actually, since it's one of these disorders, they can get out of pain. This is not something they have to live with. There's nothing wrong with their body. And it is just a learned response at the level of the primitive brain, and they can get better. And that's the first thing they need to understand. And once they can understand that, then we start talking to them about the treatment. And that involves a very specific kind of cognitive behavioral therapy focused on these types of problems, and then clinical hypnosis.
What does cognitive behavioral therapy look like when you're talking about GI psychology?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of providers out there who provide CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Unfortunately, there aren't very many who are trained to to use CBT with GI related problems. And so there's certain targets of treatment when we're using CBT. One is a specific kind of anxiety called hypervigilance. And it's an anxiety that patients often start feeling towards their own body sensations. So at some point, and it can happen in various ways, their own body sensations become the target of their anxiety. And so they start monitoring. They're always paying attention to how their stomach is feeling. They're wondering if it's going to get worse, or if I go to school, what if my stomach starts hurting? So it's like this anxiety, and we need to break that cycle, because when they're anxious, it's actually making their stomach symptoms worse.
And at what point are you working not only with the child, but with the parents, so that they can start transitioning the skills that the child is learning in practice into their home, and then hopefully out into the real world?
Yeah, the extent that we work with the parents is very dependent on the nature of the problem coming in. So you might have a bunch of different kids, all, let's say, with IBS. Their stomach hurts, maybe they have to go to the bathroom a lot, but one kid is still doing all their activities, they're still going to school, but they're just having this chronic pain. There's not a lot of work that needs to be done then with the parent. We're teaching the kids some skills, and we might need the parents to help remind them to use those skills, and that's pretty much it. On the other side of the extreme is a kid that isn't doing any activities anymore, pretty much staying home, not going to school, even afraid maybe to take long car rides. That's the other extreme. With a situation like that, we're working a lot with the parents, because we need to help them with a behavioral plan to slowly begin to expand that child's world again, because it's become so constricted, and there's so much anxiety tied into that, that we need the parents' help for that. And so there would be a lot of work with the parents coming up with a behavioral plan, and then also teaching the kid different skills so that they can use those skills, and then the parents can help prompt them. So that's the other side of things.
Have you seen children get diagnosed beyond the disorder of gut-brain connection, like either a misdiagnosis or a false start, or, you know, maybe anxiety, ADHD, autism? Has there ever been other school-related diagnoses beyond the gut-brain disorder that then, once you've had the opportunity to kind of get under the hood with that family, with that child, that you have them rethink the process and labeling that child?
Yeah. Everyone that works for the private practice, you know, which is called GI psychology, they all come in as well-rounded therapists who are able to treat kids and able to treat all the common problems that kids have. And then they're given, you know, 3 to 6 months of very specific training to get that expertise in chronic pain and GI symptoms. And so what we often see is a really nice way of working, which is we might come in and treat the GI issue, but while we're working, we might discover, okay, they have ADHD, they've got social anxiety on top of that, maybe they're on the autism spectrum, you know. And since the treatment for the pain and the GI symptoms tend to be relatively short-term treatments that have a pretty high success rate, that is a really nice way to transition into working with these other issues. And so that's a pattern that often happens. You treat the GI symptoms, and then they trust you, they like working with you, and you can help them with their social anxiety, their depression, their family issues, whatever it is.
I like that. And then in turn, help them to then the family, the child, advocate for what they need in school and life and all of the fun beyonds. So you had mentioned clinical hypnosis. I would love to take some time to kind of have a conversation. What is clinical hypnosis, and how can clinical hypnosis address GI issues? Because I think some people that are listening think of hypnosis in a way that is not exactly what you're doing in your clinic.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you put it in that way, because that is exactly what I'm going to talk about, which is there's two types of hypnosis. There's entertainment hypnosis, and then there's clinical hypnosis. And the problem is everybody knows entertainment hypnosis. You know, it's in the movies, it's on these weird hypnosis stage shows, TV, YouTube, everybody knows it. And it has very little connection to clinical hypnosis. And sometimes I feel bad for those poor researchers. They're spending their careers showing how effective it is for all these different disorders. And then everything they're doing just gets overshadowed by, you know, the next weird movie where, you know, somebody controls their mind or makes some magical thing happen, you know? And I mean, I love that. I think it's fun too. And, you know, when I see it in a movie, I don't get mad. I think my wife probably gets more mad than me when she sees it being mischaracterized. I just think it's silly. But really, clinical hypnosis is actually a very simple thing. All humans go in and out of a trance throughout their day. You know, you're daydreaming, you know, and you snap back and you're like, oh, what'd I miss? That's an example of a trance. You know, your teenager is on their phone. You call them three or four times and you know that they can hear you. But when they pop out of that phone, they're like, I didn't hear you. You didn't call me.
Right.
They're in a trance. Trance is happening all the time. When I drive to work, I go immediately into a trance when I'm in the car. And then I come out of the trance when I get there and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm at work. Humans are in and out. It's a normal state. And so hypnosis is just about teaching people to go into trance deliberately instead of accidentally. And what we found is that when people are in trance, they're able to do certain things that they can't do when they're in that normal state of consciousness. And one of those things is to be able to kind of make changes to that mind-body connection. So I'll back up for 1 second. So one of the other big problems we see in IBS, chronic pain, things like that, is something called visceral hypersensitivity. And that's basically where the brain is taking normal sensations and then cranking the volume up really high. It'd be like if you're listening to music and as a joke, somebody just turned the volume up really loud. It might be good music, but it would be painful. And so that's what the brain is doing. What we can do in hypnosis when people are in trance is we can teach them how to turn that volume down. And, you know, it's not a particularly hard thing to do because trance is so natural.
Can you give us an example of how you would prep a child or a student that is going to be entering clinical hypnosis?
Yeah. So I would spend some time just letting them know a little of what I talked to you about, which is the difference between entertainment and clinical. And once they understand that, we would talk about different examples of trance and how it's naturally happening all the time. And then depending on the child's age, we would do some tests. And they're really simple, kind of fun, actually, tests to find out what kind of talent they have for clinical hypnosis. And the research shows that people's talent for hypnosis is kind of on a bell curve. So there's a few out there who are just amazing at it, a few out there that are just terrible, and most people are average. And what I tell people is we don't need you to be amazing. We just need you to not be terrible. And, and odds are you're going to be fine because we just need pretty much average or above. And so we do those tests and then depending on how they do, and most people are fine, then we start introducing them to hypnosis. And the thing that's kind of fun is the younger the kid, the less we have to do any formal technique, because young kids have such an amazing imagination, and imagination and hypnosis are very closely related. So we're always using imagination when we're using hypnosis. And so with little kids, you just start you just start telling them a story and then have them imagine different things. And that's really all you need to do.
After a session, how would one feel?
I would say for the majority of people, what they'll notice is that they're going to feel much more relaxed and just kind of calm. And I joke that that's a side effect of hypnosis, is feeling relaxed and calm. The only,
we could all use that.
Yeah. And and that's actually another thing, is when patients come in, you know, let's say to work with pain, they're going to learn hypnosis, but they're also going to learn self-hypnosis, which I think is the most important part. And that is then going to give them a tool that they can use, not just for their pain, but for their anxiety, if they want to help themselves create new habits. It's just a nice thing to have in their back pocket whenever they need it in life.
And I loved how you brought that up. I was going to ask you that in terms of being able to transfer that skill into the real world, and to be able to learn how to do that is really a great life skill, no matter the situation, whether it's school or home or in the workplace, in terms of being able to implement what they've learned with you and to be able to transfer that of what they're doing to kind of keep up the hard work that they did inside the clinic with you, so that they can have greater success when they leave.
And one of the things, and that reminds me of one of the things, is, you know, when patients already have a therapist, you know, let's say they have an anxiety disorder and then they've got this gut brain problem too. This works really well with having another therapist. They continue to see their therapist. They come to us for, it's actually only about 10 sessions. And then the skills they need also help them in therapy, you know, with anxiety and with other things. And what we find is when they work with us, they start making even more progress in their normal therapy.
Conversation. Can you explain that chronic pain cycle and how it impacts children and teens? We kind of touched upon it, but just can you kind of reiterate that chronic pain cycle? And then also, how does that show up behaviorally, so that as professionals listening, they can kind of keep their eye out for that, but also for parents as well?
So I can give you an example. Let's say you have a kid who's already a little anxious and something happens where they get an injury and, you know, maybe they sprain their ankle, and, you know, ankle sprains are going to take a week, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks to heal. And then you give them that time, but then what you notice is the pain doesn't seem to be going away. And you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, you know, I'm not seeing anything wrong, but maybe they just need more time. And the pain just doesn't seem to be going away. And so at that point, what is most likely has happened is now there's distrust from their primitive brain about that ankle. And so then what happens when the primitive brain doesn't trust the body is that it turns those signals that are safe into danger signals. And danger signals from the brain get turned into pain. And so when we're anxious about something in our body, it very easily gets turned into pain. And so then the cycle begins. And then we start avoiding certain activities and our life kind of shrinks down. And because the pain is in the brain, it can even spread. So now it's not just the ankle. Maybe the knee starts hurting. Maybe they're getting headaches, because fundamentally what they're learning it from at the primitive brain level is I can't trust my body. Yeah.
So what are some do's and don'ts then for dealing with activity avoidance or school avoidance, life avoidance? You talked about shrinking down. So as a caregiver, what are some do's and don'ts that we can implement for dealing with this?
And it's very similar to what I said earlier, which is, you know, you want to do your due diligence and get it checked out. And once you know that there's no clear structural problem, right? There's no problem in the tissue, that there's no broken bone, the tendons aren't snapped or ripped or anything like that, right? Then you want to let your child know that they're safe. And you want to do that verbally, but you also want to do that in terms of how you're acting towards them. And you don't want to be acting towards them in a way that like, oh, my little fragile baby. Oh, you know, that isn't the message they need right then. They need that sometimes, but not for a chronic pain situation, because that tells them, oh, I am a fragile little baby. I need help. And then they keep viewing their body with a lens of danger. I can't trust my body. It's dangerous. And so the message, the better message is, I know it's uncomfortable. I know, you know, this is hurting right now, but we still need to go to your friend's house. He's expecting you, you know, just have a drink of water, relax for a second, and we're going to go over there. You know, so it's still, it's kind of a no nonsense, but there's a little bit of empathy there, but you're getting them moving.
And I also would think just the follow-up, right? So you get them moving, right? You have the empathy with kind of the stronghold at the same time, that little sweet spot balance. And then there needs to be some sort of follow-up, I would imagine, in terms of they go to their friend's house, they go to school and they come back, some sort of debriefing to, I don't know, in psychology terms, if it's breaking that cycle or just to let them know, hey, look, you did do this hard thing. You were feeling uncomfortable. How do you feel now? How did you feel when you were there? Kind of conversation. Is that right?
That is so, so right. And I love it. I love it. You're absolutely right. And they not only had a great time, but they didn't notice their pain. And maybe they'll say, oh, my pain was there. I just didn't notice it. If you didn't notice it, then it wasn't there.
Right.
And that's a big clue that you've got what they call neuroplastic pain, meaning pain that's being generated in the brain. And so you absolutely need that debrief to emphasize to the kid, hey, your body's actually fine. Your body's actually fine. It's just your brain is a little confused. It thinks there's something wrong, but there isn't actually anything wrong. One kind of silly example is how the brain can get confused is maybe a little gross, but it's with nausea. So as an example, if you eat something that's kind of bad, sometimes you can get nauseous and maybe even throw up. And maybe it was a bad, you know, a bad orange, let's say it had gone bad and you know, your body detected that. And so it threw up. The next time you go to eat an orange, it might be a perfectly good orange, fresh, beautiful. But guess what might happen? Yep. Your brain is going to give you nausea, not because there's anything wrong, but because it's scared. And it's learned to be scared of oranges. And the brain can do that with almost anything.
Well, and I love that analogy to share with students, with children, so that they're getting the message that they're safe. They're getting the message that they're cared for and with a positive message versus this is all in your head, move on, that they're really understanding why their brain is feeling the way it is. And I think that in itself is empowering for kids to have that knowledge of the why and that they don't feel like it's impacting their confidence.
Yeah, that's such an important piece is they can understand why and they can understand what's happening and that it's a problem with miscommunication with the brain. And, you know, we have the CBT to help teach them that. We also have clinical hypnosis, which does an amazing job of creating a felt sense of safety in these patients. And so the combination of the two really works wonders.
It does. It sounds like a powerhouse to have those two interrelate. And then for the parent to understand what's happening, for the child to understand what's happening, and then have the ability to communicate and collaborate with other folks on that child's team, whether it's a classroom teacher or another therapist, so that everybody's understanding what's impacting the child and how to better support that child.
Yeah, because when everybody on the team understands the nature of the problem, then we can all be giving the same message. We can all be pushing in the same direction. We're all working to generate safety for the kid.
That's right. And I think when everybody understands the nature, I like how you put that, then from, you know, just from my special education brain, I'm thinking, how can we support the child inside of a classroom, the accommodations? And I think the crux of that is understanding where this is coming from. What does it look like? How? So really doing those kind of skill set reminders so that we can then develop an individualized plan or 504 accommodations for that child so that they can feel safe at school, confident at school, and then they're able to be ready to learn versus kind of thinking about how they're feeling and feeling anxious and not seen or heard at school.
Absolutely. And that actually reminded me, in terms of accommodations, you know, every patient is going to be different. Every patient with pain, GI pain, body pain, joint pain is going to be different. And they'll all have what's called different safety behaviors. And these are behaviors that are good and bad. They're bad in the longer term sense of we're trying to teach them that there actually isn't anything wrong with their body, right? But they're good in the short term sense of sometimes they need to do these behaviors in order to get that sense of safety back because the pain is just too intense. The symptoms are just too intense. And they need to just dial it down. And it's going to be different for each person. Some kids might need to get up and walk around. Some kids standing up and walking around isn't good. They need to sit down. They need to be in a quiet place. Some people need to be in a dark room. Maybe they need something warm on their belly. Some people, you know, maybe they just need to read their favorite book. But it's going to be different. And just identifying what their safety behaviors are and then working to build that in as an option with the school or whatever the environment is that we're trying to help them to feel safe in.
That's right. That's right. And excellent how you framed that information. As we wind down, Dr. Navid, is there something that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked about our topic today?
I think just the opportunity for people to understand the nature of this problem better. I think we did a great job with that because I think too often these patients, they go in to the doctor, there's nothing that's wrong. And then the message they get from the doctor and from everyone else is you just have to live with it.
Right.
And that is so not true. And that's why I'm doing what we're doing. That's why we started GI psychology, because they don't have to live with it. But the problem before was there just weren't enough people trained to do this work, right? And the other problem was that not enough people knew that this option was available. So that's what I'm trying to solve by talking on podcasts like this. And then the other part of what I do is I'm training people to do this work. And so you don't have to live with it. There is a solution and it's research-based. We've got 30 years of research showing this stuff works. We're not waving crystals in front of people, or, you know what I mean?
What is a favorite resource that you would share for parents and for professionals?
So if parents want to dive in to the disorders of gut-brain interaction and really learn about the cutting edge and what's going on there, there's some very parent-friendly resources on the Rome Foundation. So that is, if they look up Rome, I can double check. And maybe we can put it in the notes.
Absolutely. We'll put it in the show notes everybody so they can link on that and find that resource.
Yeah. And so that's going to really get them a lot of information about the gut-brain issues. And then also they can learn more. There's an association called Association for Psychophysiologic Disorders. And that's just a fancy name for how the brain and the body can interact in ways to create disorders that have nothing to do with the tissue being damaged or broken. And there's a lot of good patient information there too. And then finally, our website, so gipsychology.com. You know, we try to put as much resources for education on there as we can.
And that's exactly, I was going to ask you where folks can find you. So I'm glad you put that plug, and we will put all of the links that you have shared and your personal links in the show notes. As we wrap up, I always like to ask one final question. If you had a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Well, based on just kind of me ranting earlier, I'm going to say our billboard is going to say, you don't have to live with it. That's, I love it. That's my billboard.
You don't have to live with it.
Yeah.
And with that great advice and ways to find you and additional information, I really appreciate you taking your time today to have this conversation and really educate folks on the role that GI Health has with psychology. So thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for this opportunity. It was extremely pleasant and I love talking with you. Thank you.
Oh, you bet. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today for our Special Ed Strategist podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.